The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Well, definitely.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Fear of the octopus lies deep in the human psyche, wrote Pliny the Elder, circa AD 79. With a beak like a parrot, venom strong enough to dissolve flesh, and in some species, the strength to overpower humans, the octopus is among the most alien-looking of creatures. In captivity, they are quick to pick up on cues and rituals, are playful, and seem to recognize and respond to individuals. In a new book, the naturalist and author Cy Montgomery explores whether she can reach across the divide that split the octopus and human lineage more than a half a billion years ago to discover whether octopuses have feelings, consciousness, a soul. Her new book is called The Soul of an Octopus, and she'll be reading from it at Gibson's in Concord on Thursday. Cy Montgomery, great to have you with us.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here, Virginia.
So let's get this out of the way right at the top. I said octopuses, and I found out in your book that that is the proper way to say it.
It is, in fact. I used to love saying octopi, but you can't do that anymore, or the language police will come. Octopus is a Greek word, and I is a Latin ending.
Okay, so octopuses, we've established that. This is a creature that was long feared, you know, the stuff of legends of seamen and fishermen, the kraken, the sea monster. What is it that made them so fearsome?
I think it's because they are so alien. I mean, you would have to go to science fiction or to outer space to find someone so unlike us. And they do have enormous strength. A single sucker on a giant Pacific octopus, which can stretch 2.5 inches, 3 inches across, can lift 30 pounds. And they have 1,600 of them. So they are strong. They are different. They do have venom. There are small octopuses that have serious venom that can kill you, the blue ring octopus. So we tend to fear what we don't understand.
They're so crazy. They have mouths in their armpits. They have black blood. What are some of the other physical attributes of the octopus that you discovered?
Well, you know, we go head, body, limbs. They go body, head, limbs. And what we think should be the head is the place with all of the organs. Their lives are completely unlike ours in that, you know, we have babies when we're younger, and then we live a long time. We're a social species. They tend to be, and we don't know because there's at least 250 species of octopus and we haven't investigated the life ways of all of them, but they tend to be solitary. They are very short-lived, tragically, and they have babies at the end of their lives. So they just have a totally different way of going about life than we do.
Is that what attracted you to them?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I love other minds. This is one reason why I love animals so much. And I love people with other minds. As you know, I did a book about Temple Grandin, mm-hmm. and she's a very famous autistic person. And she'll tell you right off that her autism is responsible for some of her greatest talents. So different brains have amazing talents. And getting to know these other minds is something that's been kind of a quest of mine
throughout my life. Minds is the point here. I mean, one of the big themes of the book is this animal consciousness. Now, this is something that only recently scientists have acknowledged in, you know, birds and dogs and chimps, this kind of idea of the animal mind. Now, in the book, You do warn us about anthropomorphizing, projecting those human attributes upon animals.
Well, and we project attributes upon people all the time. I mean, every one of us who's thought some girl really liked them or wanted to play a game with a little child who started crying, it's really easy to project our own feelings onto someone else, whether they're an animal or a person. But the whole idea of anthropomorphism, I'm so glad you brought that up, Virginia, the idea of projecting human emotions onto animals implies that emotions belong to humans and arose with humans. But if you believe in the Bible, if you believe in evolution, that just makes no sense. Both of these belief systems, which I think don't disagree, tell us that we come from a common ancestor, a common family. And emotions, the ability to feel and think and know, they didn't arise de novo with humans. We inherited them from our ancestors. We're part of that family. And if you look at the brain chemicals that accompany all of our deepest feelings, those same chemicals are found across taxa. Many different animals have them, including octopuses.
Well, at the heart of this is the theory of mind, something you described. Now, what is that first, and how do octopuses do using theory of mind as a measure?
Well, theory of mind is one of the components of consciousness. And, you know, consciousness is one of those things that people try to study, and it's a very difficult thing to study in that some philosophers and scientists believe there is no such a thing. They believe there is no consciousness. But let's pretend that you and I and all of your listeners are, in fact, conscious and we know what it feels like. Okay, one of the components of that, most people agree, is the ability to imagine other minds, minds that are different from our own. And I love imagining that. Now, can an octopus imagine minds that are different from its own? Well, let's look at its life as a creature, a mollusk with no shell, who has to hunt a wide variety of prey and who has to escape an enormous variety of predators. They can change color, they can change shape, they can shoot ink, they can jet through the sea. But they have to decide what to do based on which predator is pursuing them or which prey item they must pursue. And it's my contention that they have to imagine the mind of the bird that's chasing them, or the otter, or the whale, or the fish, because they often change their strategy right in the middle of their escape or pursuit. Oh, didn't work when I shot out that ink. Oh my gosh, I'm going to pour myself down this hole. Wait, I'm going to pretend that I look like a whole bunch of snakes. No, I'm going to grab a coconut and close it around myself and make a little Quonset hut. They can do so many different displays with their chromatophores. They can look like their background, or they can look like something else. And doing all of this, all within less than 0.7 seconds, that demands that they be thinking all the time about what someone else is doing.
Mm-hmm. So thinking, not just reacting.
No. I mean, there's too many things involved here to just react. And they learn stuff. We know this from scientific experiments with animals both in the wild and in captivity. We know, for example, that octopuses recognize individual people. We know this not just from my experience, and I certainly got to know with 4 octopuses who I knew very well that they recognized me, but Dr. Jennifer Mather and Roland Anderson did experiments showing that even when people are dressed identically and when the octopus is just looking up through the water at them, they recognize individuals. They tested them. Some of the people that they met touched them with a bristly stick, and others always gave them a delicious fish. And the octopuses learned very quickly, even when the people left the bristly stick at home and didn't bring the fish, they'd move happily towards their friends who had given them a delicious fish. And the people with the bristly stick, they'd either move away or blast them in the face with icy cold salt water.
They played a lot of tricks on their keepers, too, sort of bouncing food around or hiding or retreating. And one, Athena, that you met at the New England Aquarium, seemed to show a sort of bond. What made you think that you were connected to Athena?
Well, she was the first octopus I ever met, and I really didn't know what to expect. when Scott Dowd opened up the lid and let me touch her. Well, she slid over. She turned color with emotion. She turned red, which is the color of an excited octopus, both excited when they're mad or excited when they're happy. But she looked me in the face, and as I plunged my hands and arms into that icy cold water, her arms started boiling up and her suckers began to attach to my hands and arms. But what let me know that she wasn't attacking me, that she was liking it, was one, she let me pet her head. And no one but staff had ever been given that privilege. And the other was that she turned white beneath my touch. And white is the color of a relaxed octopus.
It's like the mood ring of animals.
It's true. That's totally true. Except we don't know what all of the moods are, you know, because they can do spots. They can do stripes. They can be brown. They can be red. Some octopuses turn iridescent colors. Some are so invisible you can be looking right at the animal and not even know it's there.
I'm speaking with the naturalist and the author, Cy Montgomery. Her new book is called The Soul of an Octopus, and she's going to be reading from it at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord on Thursday. One of the things that you return to over and over again in this kind of question of octopus intelligence is that octopuses have brains that are, in a sense, decentralized.
Yes, their brains are so different from
ours. Well, because they're spread all over their body? I mean, I don't understand.
Well, you wouldn't, looking at their brain. Goodness. I mean, just to give you an example, our brain, everyone knows what the human brain looks like. It looks like a walnut in its shell. Well, first of all, they don't have the shell, and they don't have the walnut. Their brain is a ring around their throat. Our brain has four lobes, each with different functions. But people are still arguing over how many an octopus has. There could be between 50 and 75, depending on the species and how you count the lobes. But beyond that, 3/5 of their neurons are not in their brains. Most of ours are in our brains, but most of theirs are in their arms. And what that means, for one thing, is if an octopus's arm is severed, which, don't worry, it can grow it back, the arm can go off and do stuff.
What?
The arm goes off and it can turn colors, it can catch prey, and it can take the prey and start sending it back down the arm. They pass it from sucker to sucker.
Yeah, like a conveyor belt. That's one of the things that I learned.
Exactly, toward the mouth. But alas, the mouth is now far away. And some people have even suggested that octopuses may have some shy arms and some bold arms. So what is their consciousness like? What does it feel like to be an octopus? We don't know, and maybe we can't imagine. But just imagining it, I think, stretches our minds and lets us feel that consciousness is a bigger and more glorious thing than we may have imagined before.
Well, you're very immersive in this book. You learn how to scuba dive. You go to Mexico. You go to the South Pacific. What are some of the differences between those octopuses that were you found in captivity and in the wild?
Well, there are different species, for one. I did not meet giant Pacific octopuses in the wild. That's practically a technical dive. It's so cold. But I did meet several species of tropical octopuses in Mexico and in French Polynesia. Now, the ones that I knew best were, in fact, the giant Pacific octopuses in captivity. And this is going to be the case just because it's very hard to go back to a place and see the octopus you saw yesterday again and again in the mm-hmm. wild. But the octopus that I spent time with the most in the wild was an individual we called Mary Lou. And like the octopuses I knew in captivity, she was very curious. She reached out to touch me twice, to taste me with her suckers. And the great thing was, unlike in captivity, she kind of showed me around her place. Hmm. You could swim around the ocean with this octopus and watch her hunting for food, changing colors, probing crevices with her arms, thinking about who we were, wondering about us enough to want to touch us. And that was magnificent. But the ones I knew in captivity, because I got to know them better, I think I had a much deeper understanding of who they were than someone who you've just met for, you know, a matter of days.
Octopuses don't generally breed in captivity. In fact, they're often displayed alone because of their tendency to fight and even kill each other. But the aquarium in Seattle is uniquely positioned to host a special Valentine's Day event. What happened there?
Oh, yes. This was great. I got to spend Valentine's Day at the octopus blind date. And with my husband's full permission, went off to watch octopuses have sex. And this is the steamy sex scene in the book. In fact, I mean, it's so steamy that when I was describing it to my friend Jody, we're on a train going to New York, and all of a sudden we noticed the whole car had grown very, very quiet. But what they do at the Seattle Aquarium is once a year, they introduce an adult male octopus who is ready to mate with an adult female octopus who presumably is ready to mate. And I say presumably because it's not always a success. Octopus mating can sometimes be the dinner date from hell in which one octopus eats the other one, and this has happened. But for the octopus blind date that I attended, it was a huge success. In fact, it was one of the most loving, erotic things I'd ever seen. I mean, just think of it. An octopus has three hearts, so six hearts are beating as one, and 16 arms, and all of those suckers, and lots of lube. I mean, it was quite exciting to see them literally fly into each other's arms and change color with emotion. And then they both turned white. They were very relaxed. One guy said, now they're having the cigarette. And they lay in each other's arms for hours. And it was lovely to stand there and watch the public go by. And I didn't hear any snickers or any snide remarks. Instead, I heard people say, like, oh, it's beautiful. And so many people went there, since it was Valentine's Day, with their husbands, with their wives, with their dates. Also, a lot of school children who I think just went away confused. I mean, they cannot understand human sex, much less cephalopod sex. But the adults who watched this were deeply moved by this, because this is something that octopuses do at the end of their lives. It's a completion of their lives, a crescendo of their lives. And many people, thanks to the excellent naturalists who were explaining what was going on, seemed to understand this. And what was super wonderful about it is that because at the Seattle Aquarium the animals live right outside the sound where they live in the wild, the aquarium releases the octopuses so that the females can then lay eggs and start the cycle all over again.
Yeah. Well, I'll leave it to readers to find out whether you came to proof or a conclusion about the soul of an octopus. But in the book, I think you discovered something of your own soul.
Well, I certainly did. Doing this book changed my life profoundly. And, you know, who better to shepherd you along for some transformation than an octopus who can transform like no one else? One, they showed me the sea. I'd been a naturalist for 50 years, and I'd never discovered, really, you know, 70% of the surface of the globe is covered with ocean, but 90% of the habitable space on the globe is ocean. And it's the octopus that showed me the ocean, that inspired me to learn scuba and really be able to dive beneath the waves for the first time, and that's changed my life. But also it really changed my way of thinking about thinking. The people who I met at the New England Aquarium, these are people who could tame anacondas. These are people who could smell fish stress. And these are people who showed me how to see the dreams of electric eels. This profoundly changed my way of seeing that the world is so much more alive than we ever dreamed, so much more conscious and full of delight, because all these animals love their lives as we love ours. And this is something that the octopus has showed me.
Well, Cy Montgomery, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Virginia. You are the best.
Cy Montgomery is a naturalist and author of several books, including The Good, Good Pig, and most recently, The Soul of an Octopus. You can find much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Health experts have long warned office workers that prolonged sitting is detrimental to their health, with some studies linking excessive sitting to increased heart disease and diabetes. Well, help may be on the way. From standing desks to treadmill desks, office furniture manufacturers are heeding the call and reshaping the cubicle. Jennifer Jolly recently tried out some of the smart desk offerings and wrote about them for the New York Times. Jennifer Jolly is a New York Times Wired Well columnist, and welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So pardon the pun, but of all the smart desks you sampled, which one stood out the most? I couldn't help myself.
Well, the smartest desks happen to be some of the most expensive. And those are the Stir desks, one just over $4,000, one around $3,000. And what was so special about them is that they tell you when it's time to stand up, because oftentimes people get these standing desks and after a few weeks, they just end up sitting down all day. So these desks have what they have called the whisper breath. It's like the desk is breathing. It rises up and then settles back down. And that's your signal that it's time to stand up. And if you don't stand up, it'll do it again. It'll repeat that same movement. So you can only ignore it a few times and then you stand up, you tap a touch screen. There's a little 5-inch touch screen, kind of like a mini iPad, and the desk rises. You don't have to crank it. You don't have to hold the button down to make it stand up. It just rises up to your level. That's really special.
And also expensive. You mentioned just over $4,100. Yes. There is also a $3,000 model. But several desks do prompt or remind you to stand. Do we just need a nudge in order to get off our seats?
Yeah, most other desks don't actually prompt you. They don't tell you when it's time to stand up. You can set timers on your smartphone, or there might be a companion app. But this is one of the only ones on the market that actually says, okay, we're keeping track for you. So it's the only desk that says, hey, you've been sitting too long. It's time to stand up.
Well, a lot of people can't afford a $4,000 desk, and I can just imagine my boss saying, oh, you want a $4,000 desk? Are there any lower-end options?
One of my favorites in the lower end category is the just under $500 IKEA Bekant, Bekant.
Oh, of course. It's an IKEA name. Yeah, okay.
It's a weird IKEA name. And it's a no-frills motorized desk. It has a simple two-button adjustment control. The only thing is it's an IKEA desk. So the instruction manual sends shivers up my spine. I put it together wrong two times before I put it together right. But if your marriage can withstand assembling IKEA furniture, it's one of my favorites.
Well, are we really just sitting our lives away, Jennifer? And at what cost?
We truly are sitting our lives away. For every hour that you sit past 2 to 3 hours a day, you can shave your life expectancy by as much as 2 years. I mean, it's dramatic how much of a toll all this prolonged sitting has on our health. It can do everything from cause certain cancers or contribute to certain cancers, diabetes, obesity. I mean, it can really tip the scales on a lot of very serious health problems and health concerns. And I didn't realize how much of the day that I sit until I started really working on this story. And then I kept thinking, oh my gosh, I'm killing myself. And it's really amazing how hard it is to get up and move. And you don't have to just stand up. That's another thing that I learned reporting on this story. It's not just about standing up and standing still. That's almost just as bad for you. The idea is to be active. It's to move.
You mentioned some of the health benefits and mentioned tipping the scale. So I have to ask, when it comes to calories, how much of a difference does standing at a smart desk versus sitting make?
Well, the few smart desks that actually track how many calories you're burning because you're standing versus sitting showed me that I was burning about 400 additional calories a day. Now, for me, at my height, my weight, my age, that's about, in 1 week, I was able to burn about the same amount of calories as running a marathon would. So, and that's just extra calories doing what I'm kind of doing anyway, which is being at a desk working all day.
How about for craftier people out there? Is there any way to turn an existing desk into a standing desk without even the cost of that IKEA model?
Absolutely. There are so many. You Google standing desks online and you will see that there's a whole world out there of people who have been doing DIYing their own standing desks. I mean, you could put a couple of cardboard boxes on a desk. There's a really popular $22 IKEA hack out there. So definitely you can do it yourself. You can DIY it. Or there are little add-ons, things like the stand. That's just under $70. You can make any surface a standing surface and at least just try it out. And one of the things that I didn't write about in the article in this particular column is how important it is to stand on a decent surface. So you can take a yoga mat, you can double that over, that gives you a little bit of cushioning, and then wearing the right shoes, comfortable, supportive walking shoes has worked really well for me.
Well, Jennifer, I'm thinking The Onion may have had it right when the headline, "Health Experts Recommend Standing Up at Desk, Leaving Office, Never Coming Back."
I'm pretty sure that our jobs are killing us. So if the first, you know, why is my job trying to kill me? I think that's right. Get up, walk around more often than you think is possible, because that is one of the only ways to be a lot healthier.
Well, Jennifer Jolly, thank you so much for speaking to us from the road.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Jolly is a New York Times Wired Well columnist, and you'll find a link to read her article, Smart Desk to Keep You Moving. It's all on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, from neck pain to wrist alignment, depending on how it's designed, office furniture can impact our physical health in a number of ways. But office furnishing can also evoke surprisingly strong emotional reactions. Here is Roman Mars with more.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
It's a big, majestic building on Nathan Phillips Square.
And this is my friend Sean Cole in Toronto, Ontario.
New City Hall. It's formed totally of concrete. There are these two towers that sort of curve like hands cupped around a clamshell.
So this was a big deal.
When it opened in 1965.
The first modern concrete civic building for Toronto, inserted very prominently into the Victorian fabric.
Masha Kelmans used to work in the city planning office in the East Tower on floor 19. She's an architect.
The building really explored and exploited the possibilities of concrete.
Everything was about concrete in Toronto back then.
The play of opacity versus transparency. And
everything.
So the furniture really picked up on that.
Yes, even the office furniture inside City Hall was made, in part, of concrete. But let's back up.
In the 50s, Toronto decided that it needed a new City Hall. So there was an international competition. And in 58... there was a design selected by Finnish architect Villiers Revel.
But he wasn't satisfied with simply designing one of the most prominent buildings the city had ever seen. No.
Revel proposed that he was also going to design the furniture.
He wanted to design the furniture. He had a vision, but it wasn't to be.
The decision that City Hall made was to commission the furniture through a second competition. So Revel was very disappointed. It was very dramatic. He called it the biggest disappointment of his life, and he subsequently passed away.
City Hall felt bad and wanted to pick a furniture design that Revel would have approved of. They gave the commission to a company called Knoll International.
And it was the only design that used concrete?
Correct.
Desks, cabinets, coffee tables, they were wooden, but they had curved concrete legs, and they were really expensive.
And there was immediate public outcry about this furniture.
Particularly from the people who were actually using it.
There were complaints that the desks were wobbly and that when secretaries typed on them, they weren't sturdy.
But the legs are concrete. How could it not be sturdy?
It's hard to imagine, yeah.
Toronto Star, furniture rouse on again.
And we have in our research file many articles from that time with all kinds of really interesting headlines.
Globe and Mail, wobbly desks at City Hall spark new furniture controversy.
You could see right under them to the secretary's knees.
This was the 60s and hemlines were starting to get shorter.
Scandalous. Those were just a couple of the complaints. But decades later, when Masha Kelmans worked at one of those desks, it didn't wobble. When she said...
It's hard to imagine, yeah?
It was because some of the complaints make no sense to her. And not to armchair psychoanalyze a city, but maybe, she says, all of this anxiety was really about the building. This modernist monster that was so unlike all of the Victoriana around it. Maybe the furniture was just a handy scapegoat. Plus, furniture's easier to kill.
So of course, you know, as City Hall began to update itself, the furniture, since it was not valued, it was lost just simply through replacement. It was actually thrown away.
But not all of it.
It's kind of like a hunt in here, a treasure hunt, looking for them. But they are here.
In the late 80s, the city's director of urban design at the time saw what was happening.
This is a very subtle one.
And put the word out to the rest of City Hall. If you're replacing your concrete furniture, he said, send it up to floor 19. We like it.
Which is why today, whatever does remain is still housed in the urban design offices, which are within the city planning department.
There's a bit of it scattered elsewhere, too. The mayor still sits at a concrete desk. But mostly, floor 19 is the Florida of retired concrete furniture. Furniture that only an architect could love. Though I have to say...
Look at this bench.
It really started to grow on me.
So the hope is that its actual value as a rather important piece of, you know, uniquely Canadian furniture design will be recognized, and that it will receive the you know, the restoration and the protection that it deserves.
Do you miss it?
No.
This episode of 99% Invisible was produced by Sean Cole and me, Roman Mars, with support from Lunar, making a difference with creativity.
I think life is much bigger than my old office desk, to be honest.
It's a project of KALW, the American Institute of Architects San Francisco, and the Center for Architecture and Design.
It's a nice desk, though.
Agreed.
To find out more, go to 99percentinvisible.org.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What you're hearing is not synthesized, not looped. There's no digital manipulation. It's simply a saxophone and a violin in the hands of Colin Stetson and Sarah Neufeld. The Sun Roars Into View is the first track from their new album, Never Were the Way She Was. Celebrated solo performers in their own right, Stetson on saxophone and Neufeld on violin, come to the collaboration after recording and performing with the likes of Arcade Fire and Bon Iver. Colin Stetson and Sarah Neufeld will be performing at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth this Friday. It's part of the Wayward Sounds, a festival of curious music. And Colin Stetson and Sarah Neufeld, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
No loops, no digital manipulation. Why not? Was this part of the principle for the record?
Yeah, this is something that I've been getting asked since I started playing solo shows. But the impetus for it has, for me, has always been that, you know, when you're playing something that is tied completely to your physicality, it breathes, it moves, it can go wherever you go. It's attached to your being in a way that, as soon as you set something in stone and a loop pedal, it's a snapshot. That's just, you know, that's just exactly what it says. It's looped.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just going to add to that. It makes me think of the first time I saw Music for 18 Musicians.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's never looped. It's Music for 18 Musicians. So there's 18 of them. And it's incredibly repetitive and so moving and so beautiful every time, you know, a new phrase emerges out of the sort of the shimmer of the sound. But that's classical minimalism, and what we're doing also is not straight up classical minimalism at all, but none of those guys have loop.
Well, you're talking about Steve Reich, the composer of Music for 18 Musicians, and, you know, in a similar vein, Philip Glass, you know, the joke about he's always repetitive. It's the knock-knock joke. Steve Reich, who's there? Steve Reich, who's there? Who's Steve Reich? You know what I mean? And that's something that I think a lot of people are not accustomed to hearing. So are you creating a contemporary classical music sensibility that you're bringing to the masses?
Our path into it has not been, you know, through like a deep steeping in the tradition of minimalism, but rather, I think, more of an examination of the minutiae of the sounds of our respective instruments And for me, that has been the technique of circular breathing and really just focusing in very, very closely on the small bits in the sound there. And the more I've done that over the years, the more I've just opened that up and slowed things down and shined a light on the repetitive. So it's a different way of getting to a similar result.
Let's hear a little bit more. This is a track also from Never Were the Way She Was. This is With the Dark Hug of Time. I can also hear you a little bit breathing, you know, taking in. Is this what you were talking about earlier, that circular breathing?
Exactly, yeah. Circular breathing is just a simple coordination trick of breathing in air through your nose while you breathe air out through your mouth.
I know that you recorded this record at a farmhouse in Vermont, at least parts of it. I'd love to hear more about that collaboration, you know, the writing process. I know you'd collaborated on a film score before. You've worked together in Arcade Fire. But when there are just two of you, are you starting very much with a musical idea in mind and then just improvising? How does it come together?
It depended on the piece. The first piece we wrote for this album was actually in an apartment in New York City, I think that a couple of days before I had a solo show at The Kitchen, which is a... You know, it was a tremendous honor to play The Kitchen, and we wanted to treat it as a special event. And actually, Colin had been playing a couple of pieces with me solo before. So Colin was going to be there, and we actually set out on that piece to combine both of our sort of rhythmic, minimalist, physical sort of approach to writing. And I think we literally improvised, you know, most of that piece as it was. And then we tweaked and tinkered with it to through compose until we were satisfied.
Well, let's hear more of that, how that came together. This is the track called In the Vespers. Saxophone and the violin are kind of unlikely partners. When did you begin to kind of hear them together in your heads?
I mean, I can understand why to most people the pairing of violin and saxophone, the two, which are two kind of the poster child, it's the logo for classical festivals and jazz festivals.
Right.
But that's just a part of the mainstream tradition of those instruments is in terms of how they're known by most people. For us, having played our instruments in just a myriad of combinations of instruments over the course of our lives, but also in together over the past decade, the idea of doing a duo with our two instruments, we never would bat an eye at it. It was never something that would stick out that way. It was merely like, oh, I'm a little bit louder than you, so we have to adapt to these situations. But in terms of stylistic or anything, those things didn't really get into our frame of mind until people started asking us these questions.
Yeah, I mean, we both play rock music. We both are improvisers. None of those traditions set any, like, they're not boundaries that we've adhered to ever. Like, yeah. I grew up playing violin and thinking that the violin was also a guitar. You know what I mean? Like, nobody ever told me it wasn't. I couldn't really fit into the rigidity of classical education, and so I dropped out quite early because I thought it was a guitar. More. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but it's true. I was, you know, more excited by a lot of the experimental music that I heard growing up and music from all over the world. Like, I grew up listening to as much music from the continent of Africa as I did from, you know, Western Europe. So I didn't really have a super predisposed sort of parameter for my own instrument. And I think Colin's probably, although the saxophone has gotten away with probably more than the violin has in traditions.
I'm speaking with the musicians Colin Stetson and Sarah Neufeld. They're going to be performing at 3S Art Space this Friday as part of Wayward Sounds, a festival of curious music. And I'd like to follow up on those experimental traditions that you were just talking about, because as deep as they are, as an outsider looking in, it seems pretty daring to go from Grammy-winning Arcade Fire record to a purely instrumental record. That sounds avant-garde. Do you see it that way? Was that the trajectory?
Like, the starting place isn't a Grammy Award-winning Arcade Fire record. The starting place for me, I mean, that's an incredible feat for that band to have achieved. But, you know, I formed Bell Orquest with Richard Perry in 1999. We were making really weird music for experimental theater, and we were making records at the same time as Arcade Fire, and we were touring those records at the same time as Arcade Fire. You know, one band playing much more commercial friendly music and getting very big and doing very well is an excellent thing, but it doesn't negate all of the other projects that all of the other members have always had, you know, and same with Colin. I mean, Colin's been playing free music his whole life, and he's also been in Bon Iver, and he's also been in Arcade Fire. But I think that it's always nice to look at bands sometimes as like, oh, a big group of musicians with very diverse origins and wider musical experiences.
I think for both of us, since we were children, we've played in every different kind of genre, you know, available to us. And so the idea now of strictly just putting out solo records or only playing in a specific way, that's just one.
It's like only eating eggs for breakfast ever.
Yeah.
For the rest of your life.
Sometimes you get a bad one.
Sometimes you get a bad one.
Well, you're going to be performing together at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth on Friday. So what can the audience expect?
They can expect
a few good eggs.
Yeah, we're going to bring some scrambled eggs, some boiled eggs, and some poached eggs.
But
yeah,
we've put them in water, and we've done the bowl test, so the flow test, so we know that they're all good.
Well, Sarah Neufeld, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Colin, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Colin Stetson and Sarah Neufeld, they're going to be performing at 3S Art Space Wayward Sounds Festival. It's a festival of curious music. You can find more on them and the record and the festival at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please spread it around. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow, too, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.